Well, the weather's dipped here in Houston, and if you, like me, have a broken heater, as the temperature gauge plummets down to 34 degrees, you got two pairs of socks on, a Major League Soccer scarf, and a red beanie that, you, honestly, you were just looking for an excuse to pull out of the closet, then you must be here to take note with us. I am Ted. I am here with Adam. Hello, Adam.
Hey, Ted. How are you? And it is... I asked you how you are, but then I started to tell you that it is like 19 degrees here. So I hope the temperature hasn't dipped that much for you.
It may be 19 degrees, but how's your heater working?
My heater is working.
Which I mean, your heater is working.
Yeah.
All right. You're ahead of me. We tried to fire ours up for the first time, only to hear it sputter like a 1978 Studebaker.
Wait, do the sound.
They probably didn't make Studebakers in 1978, which is almost the point, because that heater didn't work.
Did it go?
Basically, it was the heater equivalent of.
Can I ask you a heater question?
Sure.
We have a heater puzzle every winter. I think I know that what I'm supposed to do is open all the heat vents in my basement, so then the basement heats up and the heat sort of rises through the house. But every year I do this, I make a big announcement. I've opened up all the vents in the house, family, and so if all of a sudden you're freezing, you let me know and we'll go back to doing it some completely different way. Does that sound right to you, opening the vents in the basement? And heating the basement?
This is the equivalent of asking, the mayor of Miami Beach, Florida, whether how much wax he should put on the bottom of his skis. I am very much not the person to ask this, but I do like the idea of all these weird rituals that we must go through once the weather drops below a certain point. Like, call up all those old spider-webby heating issue brain cells that we've been quashing for the last 8 months or so. Dust them off, see what happens. Hey, that smell, what is that burn? That burning smell is normal, right? The carbon monoxide alarm, that'll go off if something's really wrong, right? We're good, right? We're totally good. This is great. This is natural.
I like all of the, I like all these little procedures too, but I do wish that there was more confident. I wish I could just be confident about these winterly things I need to do. Instead, I just want to go ask the guy across the street. In fact, when we were raking our leaves the other week, this was for more of our aborted lake reefing attempt. Lake reef. Leaf raking attempt. I literally had my 9-year-old son. I told him to just sit down for a moment and watch the man across the street who knows what he's doing and not to get caught and let me know any tips that he got from it. And I was 51% joking, but 49% serious. And Logan picked up a little tip that I have employed in my leaf blowing.
And that was?
If on any website, they'll tell you when you're blowing leaves, you want to have it at a low angle and go left to right. But Logan noticed that the guy across the street goes up and down as he's blowing the leaf, and it works much better. It helps your leaf get above your grass line. So if you've got leaves stuck on the side of your grass, like right between the sidewalk and where the grass starts, it's great.
Kind of jumps them up a little bit.
Absolutely.
I like that you also divulge that you've been watching YouTube videos about leaf blowing.
Well, we just haven't even got to the first segment, which is supposed to be the segment without any form. But there's something about the fact that all of this information is available online, including all of the information about how you would heat, like if you should have the vent for your basement open and heat your basement in the winter too. But there's just so much information that you'll eventually find both things, or you'll only find one answer, but you'll have no confidence that it's the correct answer.
I'm listening to 1984 on audiobook because I never read it in high school, so it feels like one of those things I should do. It's a great reader. It's this, you know, must be some Shakespearean British actor is reading it. So it's quite good. But it's also causing me to question everything. And your point about, you know, basically being able to find a YouTube video to confirm whatever bias you already bring to the table. It's not helping my sense of security for our future as a nation.
Well, I just want to add, Ted,
not helping one bit.
You didn't read that book in high school and you're not reading it now. Someone is reading it to you. There's nothing wrong with that. Ted, what do you got? What have you written in your notebook this week?
Let's get down to business. The business of writing notes in notebooks. One coworker that I overheard was speaking to another as she left in a gay and happy mood for lunch. One of them said, have a good lunch. Don't drive on the sidewalk. to which the other replied, you can't tell us how to have fun.
Okay.
What do you got, Adam?
Oh, you can't tell us how to have fun. I like that. If I was that coworker, I would be taken aback by the don't drive on the sidewalk, and I wouldn't have that, like, milk toast rebuttal. Is that the right use of milk toast?
I don't think so, but she was ready.
I meant milk toast with a Q-U.
She was ready to defend the practice of driving on the sidewalk. It was like at hand, right at hand.
Nice. All right, Ted, what I've got is...
What do you got?
I was at a restaurant today for lunch. I was at Publican Quality Meats in Chicago for lunch. And I sat down and the waitress who was serving me was also serving the guy already eating, sitting next to me. And she says to him, how's everything? And he says... Where did you get this bread? That's how I heard it. But it turned out after some time, like after 10 or 15 minutes, they continued the bread conversation, and I learned that what he was really saying was, where did you get this bread? But it didn't sound like that at all. Yeah.
I mean, did you read the waitress's response that she took it the right way? So was it you mishearing or was it him misspeaking?
It was definitely him misspeaking, but I think she had some context. I think she knew that the sandwich that he was eating was on, like, the best bread in the world. So she just told him where they got the bread. And then he must have murmured something positively. And then she came around again 10 minutes later once he'd settled down on the bread issue. And then she was like, isn't that the best bread? Everybody loves that bread. It's the best bread in town.
And that enabled you to revise your horrified stance on the interaction. Yeah.
Oh, well, I was delighted. I preferred it the way I heard it, honestly.
Well, once you regain consciousness after fainting from the horror of it all, then yeah, I guess you were able to enjoy it. Real question is, where did you get that bread?
Well, that's the thing. I was so distracted by the aggressive tone that I missed the answer that I think she murmured. You know, I think she nervously murmured the answer and then got away. I don't know. I'll never know where they got the bread. I do know that the spicy pickle that I had came from milk and honey. Which I'd vaguely heard of before. It was a really good spicy pickle, and at the end of my meal, I asked if I could buy a spicy pickle to bring home, and if they had any special pickle containers. She said, we do not sell them, but we do have little pickle bags, and I'll get you two. And my wife was very happy to have a slightly spicy pickle. Ted, what do you got?
I'm slightly disappointed that you didn't say, where did you get that pickle? Right? all right, you may hear some clicking in the background of my audio here. That is an old dog named Tess. Mm-hmm. Tess is our charge for the last few days and for the next couple weeks. In fact, our neighbor, we're taking care of our neighbor's dog, and she is old and blind, which just makes for an interesting dog sitting experience. So I took a number of notes on that topic. Header, Test the Blind. So these are more in bullet point format. Just kind of laid them down as the days went on, as I observed Tess going about her business. Lots of peeing and pooping on the driveway. She laid down in the dark, empty hallway as though it were beside the fireside hearth. She laid down backwards in her crate, facing the wall. She laid down, so I have another dog, Casper. He's pretty old and chill. She laid down just right in front of Casper's face while he was laying in his own crate. So just nose to nose. To his credit, he didn't respond. Her ghostly eyes wander about when you're near her head, as though she knows something.
Oh, that's cool.
Kind of a psychic vibe. But she's got, it might be cataracts, something that gives her eyes a sort of gray-blue ghostly quality. She stumbles over the kids' toys in the backyard on her way back to the back door. Got her feet tangled and slowly worked her way out of the tricycle. And then right after that, the toy fire engine. It's not funny. There's just something interesting about watching a blind dog untangle itself from a children's fire engine. She seems to have learned about the step down from the kitchen to the back patio.
Mm-hmm.
Turning pages here. Doesn't throw her off as much as it did earlier in our visit, though she will take to the wrong side of the door and knows her way just into the corner very awkwardly. She did poach Casper's leftover food, causing him to take a more aggressive stance to finishing his breakfast and dinner
Casper,
in a timely fashion.
Casper got his food stolen by a blind old dog?
That's it. I'm telling you, he's losing his edge too, but yeah. That put some pep back in this step. Tess laid down directly in front of the dishwasher for a nap, facing the dishwasher. And to which I noted a little editorial, it must be a little bit nice that all locations are created equal. Like, no matter where you are, it's comfortable. You just lie down, take a nap. Either that or it's a waking nightmare. And my
Ted, just,
final note on...
But if we could, just let's keep the editorializing out of this, okay?
Okay. I'll take that note. I appreciate it. Final note on Tess. So far, she likes to eat cardboard and paper.
Oh, this
I approached
is a sad
her
one.
When she was chewing on some paper, and I actually thought she had thrown up, but it was only spilled pencil sharpener shavings.
Oh.
So, crisis averted in that case. But that's Tess. She's our house guest. She's a sweetie. She loves to cuddle. She sleeps a lot. It's quite something to watch her learn her way around. I mean, she's been here for 2 or 3 days and she already has a pretty good sense of how to find her way back to the back door from our big old backyard. And she literally is blind. She literally bumps into things like she can't see them. So it's really something. And I should have said what kind of dog she is. She's a smallish shepherd, like a, I don't know if it's an Australian shepherd or she's a sheepdog. She's a herder. Her owner, our neighbor, is an Australian woman who herded sheep not long ago. And so that's Tess's background. She's pretty good at getting around.
When you say a small sheepdog, you know what I think? I think she's like a dog then, huh? She's just one of those dogs.
She's a dog.
Means
four legs,
to me.
Tail, two ears. It's like those dogs that look like they're just ready to sprint at any point. A little triangle nose, black and white. Just
sounds like a real dog type dog.
Yeah, she's just a doggish, just a doggeroni type dogger.
Real dogged kind of. Do you think I got a couple? Well, I got a question, and then
yeah.
Do you think that when she lost her vision, her other senses became heightened, allowing her to better navigate around the house and fight crime?
I she does disappear from about 8 p.m. till like 7 a.m. the next morning.
Right, and then we're sometimes sure she's bloody does. A little, but she looks her mm-hmm. wounds.
She always plays it off super smoothly.
Yeah.
What else you got, Adam?
Ted, I wrote in my notebook about a trip we took to the Arboretum the other day, and it's kind of a shaggy one. It's long and it's dogged, maybe. I was trying to do the thing that I've mentioned a few times and we've talked about. Like David Sedaris says that what he does when he takes little notes in his notebook, and then the next day he tries to focus on writing about the moments in the day that he in the previous day that he felt the most present. So I've got a couple things about the Arboretum here. The first is we became members of the Arboretum upon arrival. So we drove into the Arboretum. They charge you per person, per body in the car. First thing we did was we go to the membership desk. We sign up for the membership, and the person signing us up makes a strange comment that as a courtesy, they would extend the $5 guest charge to two of us. There were four of us there. And I thought I was getting ripped off there. And so I was like, explain this courtesy to me again. And she explained it in a way that was even more confusing. And so I said, you know what? I'm sure you are giving me a deal. It's fine. Okay, that's fine. Even though I wasn't sure she was giving me a deal. And it turned out she wasn't. And her guilt must have overtaken her. Because even though I said it's fine, she had me wait to speak to a manager who explained to me in more detail that they were ripping us off for $10. They weren't giving us the discount charge. And they actually said to us, they said that because when we entered at the gate, so now I sound like I'm just nitpicking, but I love the courtesy and the rules and when we entered at the gate that day, we were not members, and so they were giving us the member benefit 5 minutes later, but only for two of our guests, not for all three of our guests. And it was one of those things. It was a real web moment, and I was really trying to rein it in. And afterwards, I just kept saying to Jennifer, I was like, I wasn't too bad there, right? Like, I gave up really early, and she said she would have me talk to the manager. And Jennifer's like, yeah, it was fine. I didn't understand. Yeah, it was fine, Adam, which you know, she did not mean. So that was one of our things.
I haven't talked to the manager of an establishment.
Right.
Maybe in my entire life.
I didn't ask for the manager.
The fact that for you speaking to the manager and considering that to have left the confrontation early is truly, I feel like I'm watching an alien life form.
I was really trying to get out of it, but I was getting ripped off, and they were describing it as a courtesy, and I knew it was happening, and I was just like, no, it's fine. It's fine. The interaction ended with the woman continuing to debate the policy.
Please put your manager in front of me so I can tell him that it's fine.
Which I didn't ask for that manager. In fact, I said I didn't need that manager. I know it was a real web moment.
Can we carve that into your tombstone? I didn't ask for that manager and I didn't need that manager.
I think we all know that I need the manager. So I think it should just say, I didn't ask for that manager. Yeah. Adam Webb, husband, father, comma, didn't ask for the manager, but talked to the manager a lot.
Did they let you into the Arboretum after all this?
Yes, and I apologized. I think I may have apologized by saying, I hope I wasn't being much of a dick. I didn't say that, I don't think. But I feel like I was definitely thinking it. I wasn't being
a... Well, they probably listened to the podcast.
Right. Well, I told them all about it after I complained.
Thank God. Yeah.
So we were at the Arboretum because they've got this amazing... exhibit. The Arboretum is, I don't know how big it is, but I know there is a 7-mile loop that you can hike or drive to see all or most of the trees. And along this 7-mile loop, right now, for the next maybe year or so, they have six trolls that have been like troll sculptures made out of wood that are nestled among trees. And these sculptures are 12 feet plus tall or long. Some of them are laying down. The really tall ones are long. They're just amazing and they're beautiful. And you have a map that tells you kind of where they are, but you have to go on a troll hunt. The kids love it. The adults love it. It is fantastic. The other incident that I wrote down, we were looking at all of the trolls have a sign that say, please hug, but do not climb. So we had been telling our boys, you know, hug, but do not climb. And we get to one troll that's laying down, and there are parents putting kids inside of the troll's mouth. And we tell our kids, you know, no, you just hug it. Just don't climb into it. Just hug it. And our oldest is like sort of tells another kid not to, and we even tell him, no, he does what he wants. Just, you know, don't, you're not doing it, whatever. And we realize then a few minutes later that this particular one says, please hug, do not climb. And then underneath it says, but, step into its mouth if you dare for a photo opportunity. And we're like, we didn't like tell anybody else what to do. So it's fine. It's all right. And so we go back and our kids are starting to try to climb into the mouth, and the scene plays out with another child and another mom, and that kid starts climbing and she tells him not to climb. And I turn to her and I was like, we just went through this. And we thought too, we just told our kids not to climb. And then it turns out that there's this, and the mom goes, I don't want my kid climbing in there. I went, okay. And I walked away meekly, and I turned to my wife and I was like, well, was that me or was I okay there? She's like, you were fine.
It's an unfortunate rule of parenthood that you never come out better by offering your input, no matter how accurate or well-intentioned you are.
Oh.
You're just better off letting them figure it out. Do you agree with that statement?
And that's exactly what I was thinking, especially in that moment. And in that moment, I was thinking, why do I ever try to talk to anyone? Because I had no animosity. I had no, you know, I was not. No. What I was saying was, I guess, I was the fool too. Don't worry, we don't have to. Yeah. And she's not having it.
I mean, I think part of it is it's difficult to impart nuanced messages anywhere, much less trying to impart a relatively nuanced message when children are screaming and you got trolls and people are your intention was great, but the for your message to make sense required so much emotional information to be delivered.
Yeah.
In such a short period of time, there's just no, but I do feel like everybody goes through this, where you have these moments where you're like, man, I have got this message that I could give it a shot here.
Mm-hmm.
And I save them a minute and a half of what I just went through. But it's just how often does it pay off?
Right. It's not like I was going to make a friend, no matter how well it went, you know?
Well, and you know, what would you have saved them? Basically a flicker of hesitation that really at the end of the day has no consequence.
Right.
Except that they'll talk about it on their podcast later that night. But I think that's so universal. And then I think having kids, you are struck with this impulse to kind of share with other parents and help them understand the weird rules and this and that. Oh, actually, kids, they do have a kids menu, or oh, they do. You can just sort of blah, blah, blah. But all of that stuff is, not only is it difficult to transmit to another human, it's difficult when there are other tiny humans running around whose only goal seems to be to sabotage every single attempt at communication that you might ever make. But kudos, and I applaud your effort. But I can't say I'm surprised at the end result.
Yeah, well, next time I'm just going troll hunting solo.
So you bring up the shagginess of this Does that conclude your what do you
got? That includes my what do you got. It was sort of written in a long, rambling way, and those were the highlights or lowlights, as it were.
Yeah. And, you know, that makes me think of something that I kind of wanted to bring up as we're constantly thinking about taking notes, you know, of the occurrences of our days and you know, when you see something, kind of jotting it down quickly, because it truly, I mean, one thing I've learned, or not learned, but had reinforced in the last week or so, which I think is constantly reinforced, is that truly, if I literally don't write something down immediately, it will disappear.
Yes.
And that is a truism that just never fails, even if it's 20 minutes later. And you think to yourself, what was that thing I was going to remember? But one thing I've been doing lately is jotting down a very quick note about, just to remind myself of what I wanted to take note of. And then I'll sit down later at the computer, fire up a Google Doc that's just a journaled Google Doc, and type out the anecdote. And so to me, I mean, I bring it up because I think we're always talking about and around kind of the tension between digital and analog. But I you know, reading Sedaris's book of diary entries too, it's they're so, you know, the length of them is interesting because they're not long. They're short, but they still kind of go above, you know, what you might comfortably handwrite in a minute or two. It's clear there's some, you know, there's stopping and reflecting. And so when I get in front of this Google Doc, I was kind of inspired by that. But there's just something about sitting in front of a computer and having that extra bit of speed and that extra bit of dexterity that an anecdote takes on a little more than it would if I was trying to, you know, kind of write long and write shaggy, as you call it, in my notebook. And I mean, some part of me feels like I'm cheating on the field notes a little bit, but another part of me feels like I'm giving myself a chance to kind of finish my thoughts a little more, to maybe touch on several different thoughts, and it's faster. And there's, I mean, I almost find sometimes when I read through long form stuff that I've written by hand, I'll sort of skip over sentences that feel like they should be there.
Yep.
Or, you know, shorthand turns into kind of super shorthand that's almost like, wow, did I really write that? That's like, there's almost nothing there to work with. So to me, it's an interesting dichotomy, and it does make things a little more shaggy. You end up with chunks of notes in different places, which is never particularly fun. But I don't know. There's just something about if your impulse is to write an anecdote, it's hard to replace that work at the keyboard for complete thoughts.
Yeah, there's almost a feeling like by just writing it down in the notebook, we're only doing half the job. Not that either of us are necessarily like looking to publish our diary entries, or we're not actively turning them into essays. But I guess there's like no polishing to it.
Oh, Adam, I will be carrying on Aeneas Nin's legacy.
Okay.
That's my goal. Yeah, have I not sent you my book of essays yet?
Are they...
A young man's journey from
through
the south of France in the early 70s.
I'm pretty sure that hit my spam filter. I've got a I got a pretty strong spam filter, and I'll check that out. Yeah.
All right.
The south of France, huh?
Sorry to interrupt. Carry
no,
carry
was it your thought. Was it a seductive journey?
You'll have to read it.
I guess I will.
Okay, so half the work. I love that idea. Expand on that
idea. Well, it's troubling too, because I don't ever do the other half of the work then. But there is something, and you know, we end up talking about Sedaris a lot, and I wonder if it's just because that book of diary entries came out a year ago. I was thinking about Sedaris this week because I finished Calypso. And I was thinking about the fact that most of those essays, that's his most recent essay collection, I have probably already read, and how as a popular author, he is unique in that I think people also seek out his essays, or they get shared a lot when they're initially published in The New Yorker or wherever they're published.
Yeah.
And so he's a writer. I mean, there are so few writers that are like actively read. He is not only actively read, but he is actively reread because, you know, yeah. I think a lot of the people who are reading the book, maybe not a lot, but more than usual, have already read many of the essays. And how something about that makes some of those stories like sort of mythical. Mythical might be the wrong word, but.
I bought a Fitbit after I read his Fitbit essay for the second time. I went out and, like, if that's not mythical in this day and age, I'm not sure what is.
Oh my gosh, this is a digression, but in one of the later essays in that book, after the Fitbit essay, he reveals that he's wearing a Fitbit and an Apple Watch on the same wrist. What a fascinating man. What a great guy.
I know. Yeah, no, I think the book of journal entries, it just, you know, the great public figures like him. And I think for me, I would include Michael Chabon in this list. I think there's a growing roster of people who fit the bill that are probably in the next generation that I'm not quite cool enough to track with. Maybe Neil Gaiman fits in there, but they manage to show you multiple facets of their creative life, you know. So, like, I think with Sedaris, you now see his journal entries, you hear his voice, you see him, you know, read live and laugh until you can't breathe, and you read his essays. So it's not a single vehicle for taking him in. And I think human beings love that. They love to see some people and creative people from different angles. And I mean not to make too big a thing of it, but I think even in your own life, as I keep notes in my notebook, and as I type out journal entries in my Google Doc, and as we blog at takenote.pod, as we make this takenote.space, and as we make this podcast, I think it's our way of wanting to pursue that for ourselves, to hear our own voice, see it play out in different ways, to feel our way around certain topics, to talk through things, to hear you. I love hearing you talk about things. That's it, you know. So I don't know. I think it's this, and you know, Stan Lee just passed away, and I don't know much about him, but I was actually taking some notes. I'm gonna do an impromptu. What do you got?
What do you got, Ted?
I wrote down. I was just thinking about Stan Lee, and I said, "What is it that is so appealing about Stan Lee?" My first bullet point, and this is I'm ill-informed, but he exudes enthusiasm for comics even while clearly a very successful businessman. He brought nerdy charm to his letters, speaking directly to people who needed to hear it most. And that's what I'm thinking, like those, you know, notes from Stan or whatever they were in the back of comic books where he's like, "Hello, friends. Mm-hmm. Listen here, like those are amazing. Those are I never read them in real time. I've just gone back over the years and, like, you know, looked at old editions. But I was like, holy cow, this guy was getting in people's heads. He was being the voice that said, it's okay for you to be the way you are. And I'm literally telling you that. I'm literally putting my nerd credentials before that was cool on display, so that you can be a part of that, and you can see me write these comics. You can see me write letters about these comics. You can hear my voice talking to you directly. And then obviously later you can literally see me, you know, cameoing in these mega movies that back in the day when I was, you know, scratching out fucking big boards and trying to sell them on, you know, Broadway or whatever, like for that to turn into the biggest media properties in the world. I think he just, in a way, embodied that multifaceted thing that we're talking about.
I think, I have a very, people are, you know, there's the Stan Lee has passed away, and there's a lot of, there's been a lot of memorializing him. I have a very different sort of, I think you came to Stan Lee through first through The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, and then into comics and into this. And like, I was reading comics in the 90s, and I was seeing those letter columns, and I wonder if just by that point, you know, all I was getting, it was great, I didn't have any problem with it, but all I was getting was that was selling more comics. That was a section, especially by the 90s, where it was like, you had a column that was written in the first person from Stan Lee, he's calling you a true believer, he's signing off Excelsior, there's some stuff in the middle, and the rest of that page is just the other comics that are on sale this week. Which is all fine. I just it's funny for me that, you know, I've been the comic reader for a long time, and I am not having the reaction to this, you know, 95-year-old creator of many of the great comics passing away that some people are, which makes me sound jaded or like I've got, and I'm not. I just, you know, he created these things.
I mean, were you were never a, correct me if I'm wrong, a traditional superhero fan.
Yeah, right? No, I was. I read all that stuff. But by the time I was reading comics, they were, you know, they were already starting to all, they'd all been affected by, like, Frank Miller's The Dark Knight. Everything was taking a slightly darker turn or an image turn. And so it's just interesting for me that you got into comics later, but you have a, you've got the, I don't know, you've got the legend of Stan Lee, whereas I had the tail end at a time when, who knows, he probably wasn't even writing that stuff anymore. Not because he didn't want to be, but maybe because the corporation was taking over. This has become a strange tangent in our memorial of Stan Lee.
No, I think, But I think, I think what interests me is that he invented that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That he was doing it in like the late 50s.
Right.
Obviously, you have your, I would never begrudge you that kind of long slog through him being just kind of a shill type guy.
Or him not even being the shill, but him being like, at some point, he was a character created by Marvel. I just want to be clear that I'm not calling this guy who created these things and was wonderful a shill. I also think Michael Chabon, speaking of I'm not calling him a shill. He did amazing things, but by the time that, like, I just didn't have the 1970s, early 80s, 1960s. I wasn't tuned into him at that point. But Michael Chabon wrote some wonderful, a brief, wonderful, like, a obituary remembrance on, I think, his Instagram, which kind of delineates, which acknowledges what did Jack Kirby create, what did Stan Lee create, and when you look at what Jack Kirby did without Stan Lee, though it was wonderful, you saw the humanism that Stan Lee brought to the characters. And I've been reading Spider-Man stories to my youngest Wiley, and that, you know, Peter Parker, Spider-Man are it's an amazing creation that is filled with heart. And Chabon was saying that it's Stan Lee that brought that heart to these characters.
Let's do this again next week, Adam. What do you say?
Sounds good, Ted.
Check us out online at takenote.space. Check us out on Twitter at TakeNotePod. Thank you very much. Bye.